The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, it's the end of the year as we know it, and I feel fine. Pete helps Guest Anonymous his way around the world. Ron goes to the NSA, oops, NIST, oops, TIS, oops. Rand begins his waltz, man. A pitcher throws a curve, but we catch it. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Enterprise Leadership Network provides an intimate forum for C-level executives to gather and discuss key issues of the day. ELN is about building community, innovation, and collaboration with other ambitious, high-performing enterprise leaders through the exchange of ideas and information. You'll be able to participate in roundtable discussions, intimate in-person conferences, networking dinner events in your area, and a national forum. When you join Enterprise Leadership Network, ELN, you are welcomed into the fold of a private network of C-suite, senior executives, and accomplished VPs where you can build a solid network of peer relationships. Carve out an executive career path, build your executive presence and learn how to become a leadership and executive influencer. As an angel-to-exit portfolio company, other portfolio companies enjoy special privileges and access to ELN events and help host online forums, panels, and events. Take advantage of this unique opportunity to build relationships, grow your company, and affect positive change by attending and participating or sponsoring these outstanding networking events. To join other executives, become a member at ELN3.com today and grow your executive network.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. Credible figures place the economic impact of cyber attacks at more than $1 trillion and growing. Average losses per incident are widely reported in the range of 4 million worldwide and over 9 million in the U.S. Thank goodness none of my companies are worth that much, so I'm pretty safe by comparison. And that's breaking news on The Cyber Show. How do we know we're being successful at The Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show. Only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Here's Chris and Fred in an extended discussion.
Disinformation will always exist. The solution to disinformation is not to freak out, but get your news from reliable sources and think critically about everything that you hear. Think critically about everything that you hear.
You know, to believe.
Which then brings us to the recent media stories surrounding the events in the Middle East. And I don't want to get into the politics of it, so I won't. But you see a video I saw on one of the news channels, one of the big, you know, national news channels. You see this video. And the video has men of, we'll call it fighting age, carrying children into a crater, coming towards the camera. And they keep coming towards the camera and they come out of the crater with the child. And the child looks perfectly fine to me. And the announcer is saying, children killed in, you know, whatever bombing and, you know, injured and all these bad things. But all you actually see in the picture is somebody running into the crater with a child that doesn't look unhappy or injured in any way and then running back out towards camera. And if you just try and look at the facts of what you see versus what's being said, they're different. They're just, what's being said is not justified by the picture. It's just an image to create some concept in your mind. And this is actually a place where I think AI can help. And we talked about this yesterday on one of our internal discussions, right? So the idea here is that AI today can take that picture and turn it into a description of what's happening. It can say, man with boy running into crater and then running out of crater towards camera. And then you can take the words, you know, turn the words into text, and you compare the two. And you can probably use AI to very instantly and automatically say, no, so sorry, the words don't match the scene.
Yeah, and as a general example, you know, does the video match, you know, the topic, right? And that's the kind of thing that, you know, human, you know, fact checkers and others will dig into it and say, look, that's actually the sky's wrong. That's not the day, or that's a different time of year, or that picture is from 5 years ago. And it's, again, it's a lot of time to transparency issues that AI can just, you know, as we're learning these days, just sort through it now. You just tell me right away, you know, in my app, in my Facebook app, on my phone, don't, you know, require a bunch of researchers to do it. Just flag that, right? You know, this says, this appears to be about this event that happened Wednesday, but the video is very clearly from 1979 or whatever, right? You know, just shorten that time.
Yeah. And now what that does is it hurts B-roll, right? And you know about B-roll, right? That's the, what they show, the film that's the generic film of such and such fighter, and they give the story about how fighters are being used in this war. Might be a different fighter flying in a different place at a different time, but it looks like it's a jet of some sort. The other side of that is this notion that the expectation is that in real time, we will see exactly what's happening. You know, and this was the first time this happens in my recollection was during the first Gulf War, when CNN was broadcasting, you know, sort of live from the battlefield, what was going on and the bombs dropping, right, and the light flashing. And that was so impressive that now, of course, everybody had to do that. But of course, we don't have the capacity to actually do that. So we had to fake it. Right? Yeah. So this expectation, you know, driving the requirement to, you know, sell the news to people. And then the disinformation, the lack of precise information surrounding the hospital, not bombing a hospital, not hitting the hospital, not caused by the people that they claimed to cause it, and all the disinformation, that rush to get the information out there is such a critical component, and the interpretation of it is so real-timey that, you know, we really need to get the technology to fix this problem if we're going to have a civil society, I think.
Oh, and we are, so we will.
Oh, good. So companies out there, startups in the cybersecurity arena who are interested in getting funded to help get rid of disinformation, the money's available, bring them on, so forth, right?
Exactly. Well, you know, timing is everything, right? You know, I got OT monitoring entirely wrong. I was almost a decade too early for that. But, you know, there's huge companies around today doing it. And yeah, this, you know, we cannot, you know, again, you follow a line forward. If something's increasing, and particularly if it's increasing in percentage of available space, and it will either reach 100% and stay there, arguably, or not. And if not, like if every piece of information had no veracity to it whatsoever, you couldn't cross the street, right? So we reach levels of, yeah, I see it as more grit in the, we're talking mechanical systems, right? You know, just grit in the systems. You know, it's not a big failure. It's just when the whole thing is just so cumbersome and clunky, we're humans. We will change it. We will find a new way to do it because we just can't live with it anymore. And a lot of it ends up being generational, right? You know, I'm old enough now. My kids are old enough now. The way we see the world are different. And it may be that my generation can't see some of the ways we solve this issue, but, you know, we will. We just will. Right.
Look, there are forces on both sides. There are forces that don't want us to solve this issue because they want to use disinformation to rule the world. And this is not new. I sort of think that what we call the good guys are going to win. But, you know, that curve isn't always that straight. You know, it doesn't always go right to where we're aiming at. And sometimes it seems to never get there, at least in our lifetimes. But it's a good thought, and we'll go with that thought for now.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.
Frauds, spies, and lies, and how to defeat them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show.
He's just another con man sitting on a hill. You see him at the board fight, closest to the kill. Looks up in the tower, sells dreams to the poor. No matter how he gets on, he always wants some more.
These holiday scams and advice are brought to you by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. You can visit their website for scams and frauds at thecybershow.co. Here we go.
When shopping online during the holiday season, or any time of year, always be wary of deals that seem too good to be true. Don't become a scammer's next victim. Every year, thousands of people become victims of holiday scams. Scammers can rob you of hard-earned money, personal information, and, at the very least, a festive mood. Scams include non-delivery scams, where you pay for goods or services you find online, but you never receive your items. Non-payment scams, where you ship purchased goods or services, but you never receive payment for them. Auction fraud, where a product you purchase was misrepresented on an auction site. Gift card fraud, where a seller asks you to pay with a prepaid card. According to the Internet Crime Complaint Center's IC3 2022 report, non-payment and non-delivery scams cost people more than $281 million that year. Credit card fraud accounted for another $264 million in losses. The IC3 receives a large volume of complaints in the early months of each year, suggesting a correlation with the previous holiday season's shopping scams.
Tips to avoid holiday scams. Whether you're the buyer or the seller, there are a number of ways you can protect yourself and your wallet. Practice good cybersecurity hygiene. Don't click any suspicious links or attachments in emails, on websites, or on social media. Phishing scams and similar crimes get you to click on links and give up personal information like your name, password, and bank account number. In some cases, you may unknowingly download malware to your device. Be especially wary if a company asks you to update your password or account information. Look up the company's phone number on your own and call the company. Know who you're buying from or selling to. Check each website's URL to make sure it's legitimate and secure. A site you're buying from should have HTTPS in the web address. If you're purchasing from a company for the first time, do your research and check reviews. Verify the legitimacy of a buyer or seller before moving forward with a purchase. If you're using an online marketplace or auction website, check their feedback rating. Be wary of buyers and sellers with mostly unfavorable feedback ratings or no ratings at all. Avoid sellers who act as authorized dealers or factory representatives of popular items in countries where there would be no such deals. Be wary of sellers who post an auction or advertisement as if they reside in the US, but then respond to questions by stating they are out of the country on business, family emergency, or similar reasons. Avoid buyers who request their purchase be shipped using a certain method to avoid customs or taxes inside another country. Be careful how you pay. Never wire money directly to a seller. Avoid paying for items with prepaid gift cards. In these scams, a seller will ask you to send them a gift card number and PIN. Instead of using that gift card for your payment, the scammer will steal the funds, and you'll never receive your item. Use a credit card when shopping online and check your statement regularly. If you see a suspicious transaction, contact your credit card company to dispute the charge. Monitor the shipping process. Always get tracking numbers for items you buy online, so you can make sure they have been shipped and can follow the delivery process. Be suspect of any credit card purchases where the address of the cardholder does not match the shipping address when you are selling. Always receive the cardholder's authorization before shipping any products. And remember, if it seems too good to be true, it probably is.
Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's all.net, and you press on books. This segment is called, How Do They Do That? While threat actors already know how, many executives don't believe it's possible. We explain it so even a CEO can understand it. One of the most recent common frauds comes in the form of a prepaid card you buy from a retail outlet. Scammers are opening these packages, getting the card information and authentication code, and resealing the packages, leaving them for you to purchase. Then, when you buy the card and put the money on it, they drain the card before you get a chance to even spend it. It's easy to do. All you need is the ability to open an envelope and reseal it. In the case of a scratch-off authentication code, you just need to scratch off the top, get the code, and put another top on it. Most people will never know the difference. And that's how you do that! The Cyber Show is brought to you by radio waves, vibrating in variations modulated by amplitude at a static frequency of 1,240,000 cycles per second, also known as 1240 kilohertz or KMBY 1240 AM. Pete Herzog can best be characterized as a hacker. He's been a hacker since he was young. He's been on both sides of the line between good and evil, if you will call it that. And his career has affected a lot of people, all the more so since he started working on open standards and Hacker High School. Here's Pete.
Okay, so we're back with Pete, and Pete's telling us the rest of the story about how he started to first use computers. But the first thing you learned was generally hacking people, and in this case, mechanical mechanism. So you had to use bypass a mechanical mechanism to get a pack of cigarettes to give to a human being so you could hack the person. And by that process, then get into the library after hours and tell us what happened next.
Well, getting into the library was so that I could get access to books that professors put behind the counters because they had answers in them. So this way I could.
They were behind the counter. You say answers. And you mean they wouldn't let students take them out because they had answers to the professor's questions? Or
yes.
Was it that they were being restrictive so that they made sure that all students had a fair shot?
I'm not sure. I'm not exactly sure. To be honest with you, all I know is that these were books that we weren't allowed to touch. And there was other books there, too, that were generally off limits so that they weren't in public circulation.
Like Harry Potter, right? In Harry Potter, they had the restricted section of the library. And now the people that we call the heroes in that particular scenario went into the restricted section to do things. But so did Voldemort, right? The bad guy. So access to the restricted section could be used for evil or for good. And so that's a common theme. Okay. So breaking the
room. But my dorm room was a lot like being under the stairs. So I think I identify more with Harry Potter. Yeah.
All right. There you go. All right. So a Harry Potter story. Good catch. Good. All right. So you went in to get the books that were behind the counter. And then what?
I saw a computer there that was like the personal computers we had in the computer lab. Of course, there was only like four or five of them. But here was one, and most of the computers in the library at the time were part of the mainframe, so they were just terminal computers. And there were some books near it, and I went into the computer, and there was prompt, and I didn't know what it was.
Yeah, when you say prompt, you don't mean on time. There was an output from the computer on the screen that looked like it was requesting to do something. It was
exactly. So I wasn't completely unaware of that it wanted an input. Obviously,
just for clarity, you didn't tell it you wanted to tell it something. It told you it wanted you to tell it something. So technically,
speaking,
it was asking you, it was inviting you to say something to it. And of course,
yes, I was lured.
You were lured. That's right. You were lured. all right. So you were lured by the computer because it had a prompt into typing something. So what did you start typing?
Help. And
help.
I need somebody. Help. Not just anybody. Help. You know, I need someone.
Help. So you asked for help. It said, come, Pete, please talk to me. And you said, help me.
Yeah. And help me. Help me help you. That's what I was basically saying. Yeah. And
so it helped you, right?
It did. And it turned out to be an FTP prompt.
FTP, file transfer protocol. Continue.
Yes. And that was my first time. It obviously gave me a bunch of abbreviated commands, which I had no idea what any of them did. And
so when you say commands, that's a That's a term of art that was used, but it's actually requests. You're not ordering it to do something. You're asking to do something, right?
Sometimes I'm ordering it, but yes, for the most part, yes. And where I, there's books next to it, and I was taking the books and I was looking up. They were basically three ring binders with pages, not books, but lists binders.
Lists of requests you could make and what those requests would do.
Yes.
And they might have called them commands, but whatever.
And there was notes in the margins with addresses of places. The one I remember.
They would say, for example, oh, use this user ID and this password, right?
No, there was no user ID or password. It was just, they were just domains and IP addresses of where to go.
Oh, so you could go there and so you followed the directions and went there.
Yes. And I figured out I could then go to, I only actually remember one of the addresses, which was ended in .fi. And it was.
Hang on now, just to be careful here. These domain name addresses have a bunch of periods in them. You're familiar with them, like all.net and the cybershow.co. So after the dot, it had fi. Now, just for clarity, technically speaking, the word fi is a word that has a meaning in English that we're not allowed to say on the show. But that's not what the fi stood for. What does the fi stand for?
Finland.
Finland. Okay. So you could go to Finland from New York. Cool.
And
okay.
My memory might be a little shoddy here, but I'm pretty sure I remember that. And I just found documents and text files and just things, and I could open them and look at them and
learn and read and learn.
Yeah. And
you're in
I
a
just
library
kept...
and you're learning, you're reading, which you're supposed to do in a library, and you're learning stuff, right?
Yes. And I just kept going to more and more places that allowed me to, and almost everything allowed me in with the login. Was it anonymous? No, it's been so long. I don't remember if the login was.
Probably the login was guest and the password was anonymous.
Right. Yes, that was it. Yes. Guest and anonymous got me in everywhere, obviously. So
you'd never asked me where I came up with those words, but I would deny any knowledge of it's standard, right? It's standard that you can log in as guest and the password is anonymous. In fact, very often, I mean, it was the case today. It's probably you can't do that much anymore. But at the time, it would say log in and use guest if you want to be a guest. And you type in guest and say the password for guest is anonymous. And you say, oh, anonymous.
Right.
Okay, you're in. So that it's not like it was tricking something. You weren't stealing it or faking it. It was just telling you, here's how you do it, because it was intended for guest access. And anonymous was intended to allow anybody that wanted to do so to be a guest.
Exactly.
Well, there you go. He was enticed into a life of crime.
Right. How can you help yourself?
Yeah, by the computer. The computer made me do it.
Well, you know, in the first segment, you're talking about the cigarette machine, right? You know, my analogs to that, which again, I guess was stealing. I was stealing play on machines. But I was actually was traveling with my parents, and my brother and I met an older guy who showed us you could scuff your feet and hold a washer and spark the edge of a pinball machine coin slot and get free games and Pong as well. So spent a lot of time shuffling around game.
I did not know that one, but if I would have known that, I definitely would have done that for pinball because I love pinball.
Right? Yeah, the pinball arcade in Chicago where I went to seventh grade, you know, it was a great arcade with foosball machines and all the kids in there. That was good fun.
I had no idea the spark would work. Okay, well, there you go. Another thing I've missed that's going to be added into my my notebook of all the ways to... Oh, wait, don't tell people about the notebooks. So this is a story of somebody who is at this edge between good and bad, right and wrong, ethical and unethical, moral and immoral, quality, understanding, and crime. And I think it's just fascinating because Pete was so much at that edge for so much of his early career. And he's, you know, come out
probably more on the right side than on the wrong side. But before I rush to judgment on that, I think we should go on to the next segment.
Well, yeah, when I met Pete, he'd already started Hacker High School.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies. We're talking with Rand Waltzman, who has a long history in the cybersecurity and artificial intelligence arena, and perhaps most importantly in the deception, counter-deception, influence operations, counter-influence operations, and related areas. Here is Rand.
We have Rand Waltzman on the show today. Hello, Rand. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. Good. So I wanted to start by talking about the beginning of your life in cyber. Starting, you know, with you don't have to tell us when and where you were born, but if you want to, you're welcome to. But your early life and how you first encountered something cyber-like.
Well, I guess the first thing I really worked on, I mean, actively worked on, was it was going to be my PhD thesis, and the title, and this is in the early 80s, and the title was going to be "The Automatic Generation of Plausible Disinformation."
Oh well, there you go. But that should be really simple, right? Almost anything you say that's a lie is probably plausible to somebody.
Well, sure. PhD was in computer science. I was an AI person, so it was an AI thesis.
There you go. All right. So wait a minute. Before that, that can't be the first time you encountered computers, right?
Oh, no. The first time I encountered computers was I started programming. If anybody knows when the first nodes of the ARPANET went online,
yeah,
that's the year I started.
Which node number?
Number one.
Oh, you were on node number one. I was like on node number 12 or something.
No. I wasn't on the nodes, but they were down. I was at Caltech, and the nodes the node was at UCLA.
Ah, yeah. Well, I was at Carnegie Mellon at that time. So
I'm trying to give a time frame.
Yeah, so, 1970s.
No, actually, it was 1969.
Close enough.
Yeah, close enough. So, and at that time, so I was at Caltech, and I had an office in the basement of the computer center at Booth Computing Center at Caltech. And I worked for a guy who was one of the first bioinformatics people ever.
Who was that?
A guy named Derek Fender. And he was doing really, really amazing work. I mean, with the computers we had then, you know, it was still punch cards in those days.
Oh, you had punch cards. That was late in the game, right? That was before that they were wiring analog stuff, right?
Yeah, no, it was a little later than that. So no, we still had punch cards. I mean, and that was my first summer job.
So when you did punch cards, did you ever have the occasion to punch an individual hole in a card or to cover up a hole to fix it?
No, but I'll tell you. But there's a funny story with that. You know, you think about it, when you're typing a punch card, how do you do a backspace? You know, if you make a mistake.
You don't, I guess. I have to fill it in.
So what do you do? So if you ever saw a key punch machine, it had this thing, it had a hopper where you had all the blank cards, and you press the line feed button, and it took a card and it put it to the first column, which was the punches. And then you had a key, and then you started typing. And every column was one character. So the cards were like 80 characters long. And so if you're typing along, you made a mistake. What you did was you pressed the feed button again, and the card that you made the mistake went to the next column. There was a reader, and another card got fed in, and then there was a duplicate button. So you held the duplicate button to duplicate the card on the new card up until the point where you got stuck, where you made the mistake, and then you pulled the other one out and threw it away and continued typing. So that's how you did a backspace on a key punch machine. So imagine my great amazement the first time I saw a CRT. You know, a screen.
When you use initials, you have to tell us. Cathode ray tube. Go ahead.
Yes, cathode ray tube, real screen, before flat screens. And the first time I saw one, the guy told me, he says, watch this. And he, of course, he pressed the key and the letter silently appeared because key punch machines were really loud. And if you were in a room with like 30 key punch machines and a lister, the lister was a machine that typed out, if you had a deck of cards, you could actually type it out on a piece of paper so you could read them all at once. But that was, all those things were really loud. I mean, it was deafening, this kind of, to be in a room full of those things. But here he pressed the key and a letter silently appeared on the screen. I said, oh, fantastic, right? And then he said, now watch this. And he pressed another key and the cursor went over and the letter was gone. And I thought to myself, my God, how could it ever get better than this?
Well, and it hasn't, right?
It's about the same.
So in that time frame, I actually, you know, had the occasion to put back holes. So, you know, when you use the punch machine, it generates all these holes. So all you have to do is take a piece of tape and tape it over the hole, and you can replace the hole. So, you know, maybe you guys had a wealth of punch cards.
Yes, we did. We had no shortage of punch cards.
Yeah, but then you were typing in the punch card. So typing in the punch card is fine when you have text or you know, a Fortran program or something like that. And then you had the last eight columns where you had to put the Hollerith field where you could put in the number of the cards. You could resort it in case you dropped the deck, right?
Yeah, I never did that.
Oh, well, you never dropped the deck. Well, obviously.
Oh, I dropped the deck. I never numbered the cards for that. No.
Oh, so you had to figure it back out. Oh, no, that hurts.
Yeah, that was a pretty horrible business. If you drop the decks, well, the decks, you know, one deck went over several boxes. I mean, you remember the boxes that were designed to fit a bunch of cards. And everybody had in their office these filing cabinets that were designed to, you know, keep the cards in. I mean, that was the long-term memory. That's what you had. You know, no thumb drives, nothing. That was it.
Except for fire, it did just great, right? You didn't have any other failures. So, but when you did this with binary cards, right, because to load the machine, you needed the binary version of the cards. You know, those were just a bunch of holes. You couldn't type them in. You had to, you know, put the right holes in the right places. And that's a more complicated thing to generate.
Yeah, but I never did. All the cards that we typed, they were just regular characters. They weren't binaries.
All right. So you were a newbie. Okay.
Nice. Yeah. Well, we didn't do well. First of all, we couldn't go near the machine. I had to leave my decks of cards to an operator, and the operators were
behind the glass wall. Sure.
Yeah. So you never saw any of that. But the thing that I always, you know, and the turnaround time depended on the time of day and how busy it was. But, you know, to do one run, it could be hours, right?
Yeah, it could be the next day. Yeah.
Yeah, it could be. And so what happens is, you know, you're expecting an output this thick, and you get there, and the output is like that.
We're on the radio, so they can't see your hands, but we get the idea. But just for clarity,
one syntax error and that did it.
Yeah, that's really the problem, right? So there was a lot more care in looking at your program. That's why you had the machine, the line printer that would print it out so you could see what it was and check it before you put it in. One character off and the whole thing just went awry, and that was that. And then you only had so much CPU time you could get. Yeah. So, you know, if you ran too long, you'd get no output. It'd just say, hey, you ran too long, you lose.
Yeah. Well, then you had to write job control language where you had to specify all the parameters, right? How much CPU time, whatever parameters you wanted, you had to set it all up.
Yeah. So those were the good old days, right?
Yeah. Lots of fun.
Okay. So let's say it's the bad old days.
Well, you can't help notice the first topic at the beginning of that piece that ran, but you know, I've always loved the progression of things, right? 1980, I have a computer class in the ninth grade in high school. We had a computer with a card reader and a printer, right? No keyboard, no terminal, you know, number two pencil and the whole thing. And, you know, that was no doubt, you know, an old machine at the time, but I always appreciate that I got to experience the tail end of that, like literally the cards, you know, one character at a time. And my handwriting is terrible, right? So you know how well that worked for me.
So, you know, the things you remember, I mean, think about what stuck in his mind. And I had forgotten, you know, these things. It's not that I had forgotten, I just never thought of them again. But the backspace problem, right? I mean, you know, you one character wrong and that's a new card, but they had the solution to that with it. And I just forgot that second one was there. But that whole key punch experience, I think I've blocked it out. Oh my goodness. Submit your deck and come back the next morning to find out you have no output at all. They said, here's the header. It says you did it and you got charged like 8 cents. You know, and it, no error message, nothing, just that was crazy. And but then the other thing that's just so impressive about when you think about it, that the whole, you know, supply chain issue, the environment, you create the environment for the punch card, so we have, you know, special cabinets, you know, that are that are suited to having, you know, rows and rows and columns of punch cards. I remember these cabinets were absolutely no use whatsoever for anything else. You know, just they were exactly the right size for a box of these things. And then the deck falling. Oh, my goodness. So I learned my number the cards lesson. And when you number the cards, you can't just number them sequentially, because when you're writing a program, you may have to insert some cards and so forth, right? So, so you know, you like leave every 10 or every 100, you know, so you only have eight bytes of the Hollerith fields. So, you know, you'd separate them out. And it reminds me of BASIC programming, which, you know, came along in the little PCs after that. When you program in BASIC, you know, you don't want to use, you know, each one has a line number. You don't want to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, because then if you have to replace line 5, you lose the current 5. You have to type in 6. You lose the 6. Oh, no. So you space them out, and then you insert in the middle. Don't make too many mistakes. So that whole thing is just such a change in the whole way you think about things, right? The way I organize things in my computers now, I organize them by date, right? So file names typically will start with a date, you know, year, 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 month, month, day, day. So it sorts right alphabetically and numerically. And I think part of this art of keeping those separations has been lost, because people are no longer constrained by typing in line numbers in BASIC and keeping their Hollerith cards in order.
Well, there's so much of what you and I always talk about in this, right? You know, and you know, right now, yesterday and today, you know, here with my family in Orlando, and we have a Raspberry Pi. We're setting up with the Liz Marine OS with lots of cool apps and an Arduino training kit. Right, build a little Arduino robot. You know, walk you through one step at a time. Get the motors working. Put different sensors on it. You know, write the code. Push the code. And do it with my kids, my son and my daughter particularly. And I had this thing with my son. You know, I was out in the workshop, oh, maybe 15 years ago or so. And I've got this crescent wrench that was totally rusted. And I kept soaking it in oils and so forth. And I just got it all apart one day. And we're doing this together. And there's 4 pieces. And those don't break down any further, you know, and being a millennial, you know, like the conversation is fascinating, you know, it's because his life is so much more on the surface. You know, he's a technical guy, you know, builds things and so forth, but not, you know, not punching cards, you know, not filing down the anode. But here we have the opportunity to drill all the way down from the current technical level and say, what we're doing is we're raising and lowering the voltage on that pin right there. Right down to the analog situation driven by the binary package layers, libraries, stuff we do all the time. So it's still all there. And I think it is worth anybody out there, get one of those Arduino kits, go through that. You'll know everything that is written about robotics, and you'll get to see all the way down through the stack for once.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that part of Arduinos. And when we got some Arduino kits some years ago to try and do some house automation, you know, it was the same thing. I recognized there was nothing there that was difficult in any way to do, because I already knew all that stuff. But I can imagine the first time you do it, it's really amazingly novel. But then the other thing, of course, is the cost. So, you know, you're used to, you know, buying a cell phone costs like, you know, hundreds of dollars, right? But I don't know, what did you pay for your robot plus the kit plus the books plus everything else for that Arduino setup?
I think $150 or something like that.
That included the robot, the motors, right, yeah. The wheels. The Arduino kit is, you know, I think you get them for $15. Maybe it's more expensive now because of supply chain issues. $20, right?
Right.
And then the other thing is they remember, right? So when you program it in, you power it up again, and it does the same cycle, and it works like a control system, right? It has that control loop in it, which is so different than the way you're used to using things in modern computers. So I think it's wonderful. I think it's a great experience. So Arduino for the audience, just look it up online and go buy an Arduino kit, try and get one. I think, so I bought one that had, I think it was 110 different things you could plug into it, which includes just a wide range of sensors and sound makers and lights and motion, all sorts of stuff. And I'm pretty sure I paid, you know, $60 or $70 by the end of the day for it. But you should get one of those kits and mess around with it. You can make a water sensor. You can make, you know, lights. I think, it, you know, there are motion sensors. I mean, you can make an alarm system, all sorts of stuff. And it reminds me of those Radio Shack kits way back when. You remember those?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Well, you know, the ultrasound sensor that comes with this kit, you know, a couple hours ago working on with my son and finding the variable in the code that gives you the distance, right? And just knowing that you can just change that number right there and move your hand farther away and the robot will move or not, right? Get down to the bits and pieces and be able to control that. You know, and I tend to surf across the surface. I like diving down deep, but there's too much to know. And it gets to the heart of a lot of the topics you and I talk about. There will continue to be more to know, and there's already too much. So how do we ever, you know, given any endeavor, put enough of it together in the time window available to make use of?
So I'll tell you one of the things that's very popular. I'm not sure how popular it is today, but certainly before the pandemic, it was very popular, was these maker spaces. And, you know, you'd go to a maker space and there'd be all sorts of people there using Arduinos and Pis or whatever they were using, hardware, software, train kits. Oh, you know, putting together old train kits, HO and whatever. So, you know, just these maker spaces are wonderful places to go. They're great places to take your kids, right? You go to the maker space and you just meet people there and then you start, you know, for a couple $100, you can play for, you know, weeks and weeks and come back and redesign things and integrate it with other people in the maker space. It is fun for those of us that are, you know, inclined that way.
Well, it's a good window into how the world around you is working. You dive in the pool once if you can.
There you go. And there's one other thing that came to my mind, and that's in that, you know, glass thing, you know, the big glass window, and you go behind it. In the back of there, there was a power switch. You know, these things took enormous amounts of power to run, these, you know, mainframes and these other, you know, devices. And there's a big power switch, and you could pull it down, and the whole bloody thing would just shut off. I mean, done. And at that time, people actually discussed, you know, what happens if, you know, Terminator or whatever. And they said, no problem. You know, just hit the power switch. We're in the room. We're good to go. Well, that's gone. And when that just started to disappear from phones, that was a big issue because you could no longer stop yourself from being tracked by pulling out the battery. And you could no longer reboot the computer by disconnecting the battery. That doesn't function anymore. You know, so all that stuff has gone away with the, you know, take out the battery and you're safe and all that stuff. But the other thing is, apparently somebody actually used that switch once to shut down a mainframe in the facility where I was working. And it turns out on those old computers, when you actually pull the switch, there's implications. Like when you turn it back on, it doesn't all come back up. You need to go in there and, you know, figure out which tube, you know, is broken. And, you know, it's mostly power supplies that tend to go bad because they're using more power and so forth. But, and it's the same with the old core memory. I have stories about the core memory as well. So that's a good start for Rand. Let's see what happens next. And of course, with his mathematical theory of deception. What was it? Not deception. What did he call it?
I think he said disinformation. I have to go back.
Disinformation. Yeah. His mathematical theory of disinformation. Hopefully we'll find out more about that soon.
This is an old poem called The Last Bug. You're out of your mind, they said with a shrug. The customer's happy. What's one little bug? But he was determined. The others went home. He spread out the program, deserted, alone. The cleaning man came. The whole room was cluttered with memory dumps, punch cards. I'm close, he muttered. The muttering got louder. Simple deduction. I've got it. It's right. Just change one instruction. It still wasn't perfect, as year followed year, and strangers would comment, is that guy still here? He died at the console of hunger and thirst. Next day he was buried, face down, 9-inch first. And the last bug in sight, an ant passing by, saluted his tombstone and whispered, nice try.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Ron Ross from the National Institute of Standards and Technologies is unique among those in the cybersecurity industry in that he has been in charge of the development of federal standards and specifications for cybersecurity since those standards were first started in their development. As such, his work has probably affected more people around the world than any other person in the cybersecurity arena and moved the course of activities in this area forward at the scale of nation states and global corporations. Here's Ron.
All right, Ron, how are you doing? It's been a long time. Welcome back.
Well, thanks, Fred. I wanted to share with your audience how I actually met you and came to know Fred Cohen. When I was at the Naval Postgraduate School, I was working on my dissertation, and we not only had to come up with a physical model of how that autonomous vehicle was going to operate in the real world, we had to actually demonstrate that we could develop a program, a Lyft program in this case. We had Lyft machines back in those days also. I wrote a Lyft program that would actually demonstrate how that path-punning algorithm would actually be developed and loaded onto a computer on a vehicle. So I had gone through almost a year's worth of development. And one day, somebody comes in and said, hey, there's something new that just hit us. It was called the Morse worm. Now, I think, I'm not sure the exact year. It might have been, I'm thinking 1987, 88 time frame.
87, 88, sounds right, somewhere in there.
Yeah, so I lost all of my Lyft program because it wasn't backed up. Yeah, I'll tell you, it was a catastrophe, but it was also a lesson learned for me that I never forgot. I'm obsessed about backing stuff up. You know, now I had to go back and recreate all of that, all the Lyft program stuff. I was able to cobble it together, and I did get back to where I needed to be. But man, that was my first exposure to, you know, what would become, you know, the viruses and the worms and Trojan horses and all of that. And of course, I knew nothing about cybersecurity at that point. That was all way before I even knew what cyber, well, we didn't even call it cybersecurity. We called it information security back in those days. And of course, that term got hijacked because people thought cyber was a better choice of words. I still don't like the term cybersecurity, but.
All right, so anyway. Let's have that discussion because, you know, cybernetics from Norbert Wiener way back in the 1940s is about sensors, actuators, communications, and control. So when you talk about information security, before the robotics, before all of the sensors and actuators associated with all the computing devices, information security had everything to do with the content. But now it has to do with the cybernetic system, with the whole feedback control mechanism. So I think the name is appropriate for the modern environment.
Yeah, I think one of the problems I have with it is because they didn't when they chose the name cybersecurity, they didn't do that for the reason you just stated. They just chose it because
it was cool.
Someone sounded cooler. And if you were asked 100 people on the street what cyber is, even scientists or engineers, you'd probably get 100 different answers. But
I'm saying sensors, actuators, communications, and control, that's what cyber is, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But a lot of people don't realize that. But well, I'm a happy camper now because I passed my dissertation defense, the murder board, if you will, and then I graduate and I go off and I get a phone call. This is the day of my graduation, and I'm expecting to become a program manager for the Army's Autonomous Vehicle Program. Surprise, surprise! I get a call from the Department of the Army. They said the guy that's sitting in your assignment, he was supposed to rotate, but he decided to extend for 1 year. So go find yourself another job. And I'm saying, what? So I had some buddies of mine that were at the National Security Agency, and I said, let me just call them up and see, hey, do you guys have any need for a computer scientist that has some skills in robotics and artificial intelligence? And they said, well, yes, we do. As a matter of fact, we have a lot of computer scientists here. We have artificial intelligence, not much going on, but it was because it was relatively new back then. I mean, there was a lot of hype in the 80s about AI. They oversold it back then, and a lot of people lost
they oversold it repeatedly since then.
Yeah, and they still might be doing that today, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's a breakthrough in marketing technology, right?
Exactly. So I've just come now from four, almost we were almost eight or 9 years on the Monterey Peninsula because we lived in Monterey, Pacific Grove, and I went to Hunter Liggett. I commuted every day down to the desert test center, but I actually came back to Pacific Grove where we lived, so my family could stay in one place. So I was lucky to be part of that Silicon Valley birth revolution. Digital research was right down the street in Pacific Grove in those days, and Gary Kildall and all of those players back in the early days. It was just a great time to be at the start of that will become the revolution that we are now seeing the fruits of today. So anyway, I ended up picking up and I went back to the National Security Agency, and this was 1990. Now, to work there, and you know, you have to have a top secret FBI clearance. So I didn't have one of those. So I had to.
So while you're waiting for your next billet, you can wait for your clearance while you do what you're not allowed to do, right?
Yeah, well, it took me about 3 months to get that clearance. And so they sent me out to NIST and to a company called Trusted Information Systems, run by Steve Walker.
So the story goes with everybody, always, everywhere.
Right. And it had to end on TIS. I was at TIS when it was sold to McAfee, right? So at the end of all that. That era, and I kept a gauntlet firewall around for the longest time just as a keepsake. But yeah, to what you and Ron were talking about, look, you know, when I got into computers, it was called data processing, which maybe was fairly accurate because by that point, you know, in computers, you know, electrical mechanical computers up through, you know, the 80s when I got involved were, you know, processing data for companies to do payrolls and in our case, you know, lumber yards, you know, inventory and point of sale and so forth. So data processing might have been close enough. And then it became information technology. Now, I don't know. I could go on all day about that. But, as Bron said, it was, you know, when I saw cybersecurity, it was information security. It was information security for a long time. Now it's cybersecurity. I love the term cybersecurity specifically because it's vague enough. Because if you really want me to get, you know, pedantic about this, data processing and information technology and information security, each of those, every single one of those words is not exact enough for its purpose. It never is, right? You know, that's is close enough. It works well enough. It forms a common understanding of what we're talking about. Because information security includes how you're walking down the street. What information are you emanating from your body by your behavior and your location on the face of the planet and yada, 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 right?
Yeah, so I think it's all about some combination of marketing and self-image. And self-image, you know, when you talk about what do you do and you say, well, I'm a cyber guy. Okay. You know, that there was a time. All right. So I got to tell you the story about when I was in graduate school at University of Southern California, graduate school, as some people call it, but it sure took a long time. So in graduate school, you know, I was an electrical engineering student. So every once in a while, you know, you're in Southern California, so you go to all sorts of interesting places, magnificent things to do in the Los Angeles area. One weekend, I decided to go to the beach. So I'm off to the beach, and I was also on the lacrosse team at USC at that point. So I was in pretty decent shape. So I had a bathing suit and a T-shirt on and walk out onto the sand and encounter a very good-looking young woman. And said hello and engaged in conversation, very pleasant, friendly, moving forward conversation until she asked what I did. And I said, I'm in electrical engineering. And she just, that was it. I'm sorry, I'm not interested at all anymore.
Yeah.
I guess if I would have said, well, I'm an actor, maybe that would have worked. I don't know what would have worked. But my point being that nowadays, if you say, you know, I work in computer security, people say, oh, wow, that's fascinating. Boy, you must have a lot of work. No, but, you know,
yeah, well,
popularity. So these days, you know, cyber, you know, I'm ready to embrace the concept that I work in cyber and let them think whatever they want. I don't care.
Well, and we, you know, there's so much in that that applies to this, you know, the cyber show, right? You know, and people listening, you know, if you have your own concerns, you're, you know, driving through Silicon Valley or whatever you're doing, thinking about your, you know, your business and all this stuff matters, right? You know, I'm always a little disappointed with security people who don't really get into it, right? Technology people writ large, okay, fine. You know, you're looking to push this thing with that lever, that gear. Security, you have to consider the people, right? And this is what we're talking about. The words you use matter. Why? I don't know. Take them one by one, put them in context, see what happens. How do people behave? Do people want to use that word? Do they want to refer to themselves with that word? You know, with all the griping about, you know, people should do this, that, and the other. So, okay, if you want them to, think about it. You know, and you know, self-image is a bloody thing, right? You know, you want people to be associated with the thing you would like them to do. And that comes down to words and feelings and emotions, right?
Yeah, so the question then is, historically, the person who was going to be in charge of cybersecurity or whatever you want to call it, there were two different ways they came to be in that position within a company. One of them was the management line, where they were manager, up the management stack. And finally, somebody said, well, what are you going to manage today? Oh, security. Okay. So you know nothing about the technology or security, but you're a manager, so you're going to manage it. And the other path was the technical path, where you're a, you know, computer guy, and you know, you're working your way up in the computer thing, and you get up to the director level, and then they put you in charge of desktops, and then you get networks. And after a while, you've been to almost everything, so they put you in charge of cybersecurity or whatever it was called, security. And because you have the contacts with all the people or whatever, so now you're the what's now called the CISO, Chief Information Security Officer. So I think what you're suggesting, I think it's fascinating that it might be that the ideal background for somebody in charge of cybersecurity is a psychology degree.
Right.
Or perhaps a psychiatry degree, because there's a lot of healing that has to be done.
Or a private detective. You know, I think of Charles, right? You know, people come, you know, our friends who came in this from law enforcement.
Yeah, Charles Preston.
Literally trying to solve a cops and robbers, detectives, you know, law enforcement, people are trying to hide things, a security issue. And they say, oh, these computer stuff is good for that. Right. And, you know, every perspective we have brings its own baggage, but you have to understand that's the thing. I got in this through the technical track more or less, but what's always fascinated with me is that same Agatha Christie stuff. It's like, why were you standing right there? Well, you got to know the whole backstory. You got to know the person. And if you know all those things, you can hack the world.
That's interesting, but that's not been that successful. A lot of people become the chief security officer after being in the military police, for example. And when that was physical security, that's maybe okay. But one of the challenges of that, especially because of the military approach to it, is, you know, the military has this indoctrination process. And what that does largely is produce people who believe in brutality, right? There's a group cohesion that comes from brutality. There's a certain brutality in the fact of what you're doing in the military, right? I mean, at the end of the day, you're, you know, fighting for your life and to take somebody else's life, even though you maybe would rather not. But you have to be willing to accept that. Whereas the vast majority of the treatment of people in the other world is such that if you're brutal towards them, you will not make them your friend. You'll make them your enemy. And that's bad for cybersecurity. So notion of punishment, this notion of group pain is averse, at least in modern society, to an effective program.
Well, you know, as I said, you know, the thing to understand is what your perspective is, right? And as I, you know, classify all the people we know in the industry, yeah, there's military folks, there's industry folks, there's technical people. As you say, those people came in, you know, from a management perspective, you know, and some odd, you know, angles. Each one brings its pros and cons, right? You know, shout out to Juan Carlos Vega, you know, go Army. We can come at this with our stuff and say, okay, I know I have this stuff. If the situation requires more than I have, or somebody who's really good at the parts that I'm a perspective I'm not bringing, I should get them involved too. And that's what the really successful people have done. You know, we as a divided country, divided world, we're all, you know, we're actually not as divided as we think we are. But in the cybersecurity community, no, we understand the strengths and weaknesses other people have because we have our own, and we put them together successfully over and over again.
Yeah, it's a team sport. So maybe what we really need is somebody who's a good coach.
Yep. Yes. Right. Ted Lasso. Can we get Ted Lasso? Right.
Yeah, that's congratulations. That's now the new qualification for head of cybersecurity, large enterprise, is previous experience in coaching sports teams successfully.
I wouldn't argue it. Wouldn't argue against it.
There you go. All right.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
Next week on the Cyber Show,
It's a whole new year, so things will be changing. Pete is exploited as a child because he's able to exploit other things. Rand creates a thinking machine, or not. Ron goes somewhere over the rainbow series. More fraud, spies, and lies, and a whole lot more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time, and bow. A good time, and bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time, and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.